I believe this is, by the way, this Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I believe we have Zafar Bengash himself on the line. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. I am with you, yes.
Yeah. Well, Zafar, we come to rely on you when all these things happen so quickly in the part of the world in which you pay a lot of attention, close attention. And you had, actually, in a previous interview with us, you made some nice points about Bangladesh that are not often thought about. You were alluding back to the time when they were part of Pakistan, and it actually they had formed, as I understood you to say, a majority within the Pakistan parliament, and this really had severe consequences. And this is something I don't think people are quite familiar with. But so here we are today, and the prime minister has left the country, and we have someone named Muhammad Yunus. And I was just speaking of him in introduction. I didn't realize that he's very close to Bill Clinton, and he received the Presidential Medal of Honor, and he won the Nobel Prize. I think the Peace Prize. I don't know how you win a Peace Prize if you're an economist. But anyway, what is going on, in your view?
Well, Bangladesh obviously is going through very difficult times. I think there are several pieces of this jigsaw puzzle that we need to put in place in order to understand the picture properly. There is no doubt that the former Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, had become an absolute dictator. She had basically, first of all, assumed that because her father, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, had led the independence struggle from Pakistan, or actually from the Pakistan Army back in 1971, that this entitled her and her family to rule Bangladesh in perpetuity. In the last 15 years, she had been in power primarily through absolutely rigged elections. There is, you know, plenty of evidence to prove that the elections were rigged, and as she tightened her grip on power, what she did was she corrupted most of the institutions in the country, especially the judiciary, the police force, bureaucracy, through patronage. You know, we need to keep in mind that Bangladesh, like many other countries in the third world, the government is the biggest employer. Because private sector has not developed properly. So government patronage plays a very large part. And what Sheikh Hasina was doing during her 15-year rule, she had, of course, ruled from 1996 to 2001 as well, and then lost to other parties. But she came back to power in 2009. And during her 15-year rule from that time, the government jobs that, as I said, the government is the largest employer in the country, government jobs were going to her party members, to their cronies and so on, and other people were left out. So she was essentially creating a one-party dictatorship. And the Chief Justice was her special man, who has been forced to resign now. The governor of the central bank has been forced to resign. Several police chiefs have been forced to resign, including many members of the bureaucracy. And this current crisis basically erupted at the beginning of July, because in June, the Supreme Court ruled that the quota system that the government had introduced, whereby 30% of all government jobs would go to people that had participated in the independence struggle back in 1971. Or, of course, many of them have died now, but these job quotas would go to their children and to their grandchildren. And keeping in mind that 400,000 university graduates come in the market every year, the students felt that, you know, they were being put at a very great disadvantage. So they protested against this. And true to her, you know, brutal nature, Hasina Wajid ordered the police to attack the students at university campuses. Many were killed. The students were not cowed down. These protests spread to other universities. Initially, their protests were focused on removing this job quota system. And when the students refused to relinquish their protests, the police and paramilitary forces intensified their attacks. Now, the crux came on August the 4th. The government imposed a curfew. The troops were called into the streets as well. But I must say that something remarkable happened earlier than that, that junior officers in the Bangladesh Army, captains, majors, etc., who are on the front line with the troops on the streets, they sent a letter to the army chief and they said that we will not obey orders to shoot at our own civilians. Now, that was really something absolutely remarkable. So the army chief, although he is related by marriage to Hasina Wajid, the ex-prime minister, he's married to her cousin, and also he was brought to power only a few months ago to the top slot by superseding a number of other generals. But when Hasina Wajid on the night of August the 4th demanded that the army shoot at these students to impose law and order, he politely but firmly refused, because he knew that if he issued the order, there is likely to be revolt in the armed forces. The young officers will not obey these orders. So he tried to dissuade Hasina Wajid from insisting on this order. So did several of her aides. Ultimately, it was her son, who was based in the U.S., who called his mother. And of course, the son was being groomed to take over after Hasina Wajid, Sheikh Hasina, relinquished power, that he would take over. But he persuaded her to not persist with this, because if the army is not with us, then we, you know, the party cannot rule. And so she was forced to resign, and she fled in a helicopter to India. Now, we need to keep in mind the larger picture as well, that, you know, under her rule, India was basically the de facto ruler of Bangladesh. And that also irked many, many people in Bangladesh. They were deeply disappointed that, they struggled for independence from Pakistan, and now they've become a vassal state of India, and that's not something that they wanted. Also, I think COVID had played a role in downgrading Bangladesh's economy, because it's a single item economy based on garments production and exports. And prior to COVID, Bangladesh economy had done well, but after COVID, things started to go down very badly. Unemployment had risen. At the political level, Sheikh Hasina basically targeted her opponents. There is a major political party, or actually two. One is the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, also led by a woman, Begum Khalida Zia.
She fell under similar kinds of charges, right?
Yes, exactly. She was accused, imprisoned. She was actually, under house arrest in hospital because she was in very poor health, and has since been released. But there is another political party that has suffered the most grievous harm. It's the Jamaat-e-Islami. It's a religious party. It has not only been banned, but most of its leaders were put through kangaroo-style trials and then hanged. They were accused of being collaborators of the Pakistan army. Now, that was, before Bangladesh had come into existence. Obviously, at that time, there were political parties that did not want Bangladesh to secede from Pakistan, but to remain united. But because those people had opted for remaining part of Pakistan, therefore they were considered traitors, and many of their leaders were executed. In fact, there's a case of a particular lawyer, young lawyer, he's a British-trained barrister. His name is Mir Arman. His father was a leader of the Jamaat-e-Islami in Bangladesh, and his father was also accused of being a traitor and collaborating with the Pakistan army, etc. And this young barrister was kidnapped from his home while his father was under trial, and he was part of the defense team for his father, his British-trained barrister. And he disappeared, and for 8 years, the government simply refused to acknowledge that they had anything to do with his disappearance. Mm. So once Sheikh Hasina fled Bangladesh, then this young, not young anymore, I mean, you know, in very bad shape. I've seen the pictures and videos. He's in very bad shape. Mir Arman, barrister Mir Arman, has been released. So have a number of other people, but there are still more than 600 people, political prisoners that are missing. Their loved ones don't know whether they're dead or alive. There are protests being held in Bangladesh for their release. Hmm. Now, to come to this aspect of Muhammad Yunus, this 84-year-old economist who has taken over, as the title goes, chief advisor to the interim government. The interim government, of course, is headed by Muhammad Yunus, but there are a lot of other people as well in it. There are, you know, professors, there are academics, there are lawyers, environmentalists, mm-hmm. and also three student leaders who, I must say, to their credit, insisted that they will not allow the Bangladesh army to dominate the future government or to impose martial law. And I think this is a good sign for Bangladesh that they have prevailed, although I really don't know exactly how this is going to proceed further, because, you know, we cannot write off the army. It is obviously the most organized force. It has the guns, and it can, you know, carry out massacres as they do in Pakistan and Egypt and other places. So that's a very, very uncertain sort of future or dark point in Bangladesh. Hmm. Naturally, the economy is in bad shape. Right now, there are two competing demands. The students are demanding that the institutions that have been corrupted during Sheikh Hasina's 15-year rule have to be reformed because they have been stuffed by Sheikh Hasina's cronies, and they are not capable of you know, delivering justice or delivering service to the people. The other demand, of course, is that elections should be held immediately so that a proper representative government comes to power. Now, both are valid arguments because elections should be held. I don't think that they should be postponed for too long.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, it is a fact, right? You have two dominant parties. You mentioned the Nationalist Party and then the Awami. You can't wish them away. They exist.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Are you going to let them compete, or are you going to use the law and block one of them?
Exactly. I don't think that Awami League should be blocked. They should be allowed to participate in elections, although some of their members, perhaps most of them, have committed crimes. But I think these should be addressed through the proper legal procedure, not through kangaroo courts, as Sina Wajid was doing.
Yes. Well, by the way, I have to say, I know you mentioned the students. I got to put in a term. I saw their statement, and they were calling for the UN to do something, and they said that it could do it because they said they had done it in the case of Iran, that they had done it with when the woman died in the bus station. And to me, that's a worrying idea because that was pure manipulation by the West, that one.
Yes, of course. You see, obviously, the students are a little naive as well because, you know, they live in a very sort of, you know, close environment. They are, of course, the students are worried about the military. Bangladesh has had several military coups. The first one occurred actually in August of 1975, when the leader of the Bangladesh movement, the father of Sheikh Hasina, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, was actually killed along with his entire family members by the army. These were young army officers, and of course they grabbed power then. And there have been other bouts of martial law in Bangladesh. So these students are wary of the army taking over. But they're also naive, as you quite rightly pointed out, that they're calling upon the UN to set up some kind of a commission of inquiry. I think they would be well advised to deal with these things internally.
Yeah, do it themselves.
That they set up, independent-minded lawyers to investigate these things properly. There are, of course, former judges that have retired who have a good track record. They can be made part of the panel so that they can investigate these things in a proper manner, in a transparent manner, that there shouldn't be any witch hunt. Unfortunately, there have been attacks on members of the Awami League because the people are enraged. These Awami League members had attacked students, carried out, their killings, etc. And that has enraged people who want to seek instant revenge. But that is not the way to go forward. I think what they need to do is to set up an internal inquiry commission and investigate this. And although the interim government has said that there will be proper investigation and all the people that have committed crimes would be investigated and if found guilty, then punished accordingly.
Yeah.
But appealing to the UN obviously is not the right course to take, for sure.
Yeah. We're speaking to Zafar Benghash, and Zafar is an authority on Islam and on the political movements in the South. I'm always trying to get all my words right, but South Asia. West Asia. About this thing of Mr. Yunus, in the background, there is, the U.S. has been trying. They meddled in Myanmar. They certainly meddle wherever they can. Now, a target of this meddling by the U.S. has been the Belt and Road Project. I noticed China has not said a word, by the way, about this. I looked, they said nothing. The Indian government, I understand, is fairly quiet. Is there any substance to the accusation that the U.S. wanted to establish a military base? I think the former prime minister said they wanted an island called St. Martin's. Do you credit that at all?
Yes, of course. 2 days ago, she actually gave an interview to this Indian magazine called Economic Times, in which she said that the U.S. wanted this island, which is a three-mile-long island in the Bay of Bengal called, as you said, St. Martin Island, and the U.S. wanted to set up a naval base or at least a monitoring station over there, and she said that she refused to allow that to happen, and that is the reason why the U.S. Ousted her. Then she also added something else, and she said that, of course, alluding to the students and the opposition groups, etc., that they wanted to carry out a bloodbath to kill a lot of students, and they wanted me to walk over the bodies of these students to remain in power, which I found a little incredible that, she herself had ordered her security forces to fire at students, and more than 450 students have been killed. In fact, on the last day, which was August the 4th of her rule, the curfew was imposed, and the students defied the curfew. That is when things escalated, because earlier on, the students were protesting against the job quota system, but then their demand escalated to her resignation because so many students were killed, and of course, thousands of students were put in prison. So then the students started to demand her resignation and oust her from power. And two factors basically you know, gel together. One was, as I mentioned earlier, the junior officers in the army telling their superiors that they will refuse to obey orders to shoot at civilians. And number two, the students persisted in their demand. And they were actually heading towards the prime minister's residence in a very posh area of Dhaka, the capital city. But the army persuaded Sheikh Hasina to leave her residence. They took her in a helicopter, and then she flew to India. Now, with respect to the U.S. position, I don't think it can be ruled out at all. I think the U.S. is definitely meddling in the internal affairs of this country. As you pointed out, they have done it in Myanmar. They have done it in Pakistan by ousting Imran Khan, although the circumstances were very
different. By the way, over a similar issue of, he said, you and I have talked about it, it's so poignant. He said to the world, I asked them, do you think I'm your slave?
Correct.
And so when those kind of things happen, it's, you know, you really want a loud noise back to the United States, butt out, right?
Yes.
And he made that noise, and he paid the price. They don't allow you to talk back.
Exactly. And you see, unfortunately, they have people within the armed forces. I think the Pakistan army is much more embedded with the U.S. army than the Bangladesh army. India exercises a lot more control over the Bangladesh army because India has trained many of these Bangladeshi officers, and they have close connections. It is true that India is actually the biggest loser in this whole game because, you know...
And they're in a curious position, right? Because the U.S. is starting to talk about them as a problem.
Yes.
And Canada talks about them as a problem. And you realize, oh, something... they're being squeezed. I think the general assumption is they're being told, take one side or the other.
Yes, of course. You see, so basically, if we look at the larger picture, definitely India is the biggest loser. China, of course, has remained silent, but I think China's interests are primarily economic rather than military. They don't want any military bases, but naturally, they would be very wary if the Americans were to get a naval base or a listening post or a, you know, spy base in the Bay of Bengal, because that would definitely affect Chinese interests. And that's not something that they want. I mean, you know, we need to keep in mind that China built a naval port for Sri Lanka, and also in Myanmar they were building a port, and all of these have been undermined by the U.S. So U.S. meddling is definitely there.
Want a base. Isn't that interesting? I mean, just to contrast, China doesn't like to put bases anywhere. The U.S. Yes. insists on them.
Yeah.
We've got to have a base.
Chinese approach is radically different. Basically, they want to bring countries and link them in an economic framework rather than a military framework. I mean, just to give you an example of Africa, for instance, the Africa Union headquarters is in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. China built that at a cost of $400 million and handed it over to the African Union and said, we don't want any money. China has built roads in other countries in Africa, countries like Botswana and Zimbabwe and so on.
Tanzania, there's a the rail goes to Lake Tanzania from the coast.
And they don't charge for it. They say, we want to let you have this. All we want is trade with you. Now, you know, the other examples that we can see, for instance, two countries in Africa, Niger, which produces a lot of uranium, and Mali, which produces a lot of gold. And in both countries, French and American, quote-unquote, peacekeeping forces were there, allegedly to fight terrorists. And yet, terrorism spread in both countries. And finally, both countries, both the Nigerians as well as Malians, kicked the French and the Americans out of their country. And the government in Mali brought in Russian forces. The terrorists had actually got into the Malian capital as well. So when they kicked the American and French forces out of there, the Russians came, and within 1 month, the Russians had driven out the terrorists out of the Malian capital. So the French and the Americans couldn't do in 10 years what the Russians did in 1 month.
Yes.
So you can see, and there's another factor as well that, you know, Mali, which is a very major gold producer, had only, there are many gold mines in Mali that the French were working on. Mali had only 68 tons of gold, whereas France had about 280 tons of gold or something. And now Mali last week announced that they are going to set up a plant to process gold, and they'll be producing 40 tons of gold a week. Now, that gives you some indication.
Now, that's development.
Exactly. And since Niger kicked out the French from Niger, a number of nuclear power plants in France have shut down because they do not have any more uranium to run these power plants. So you see, there are countries in that region emerging who are basically in the Sahel region who are taking an independent stand, and they are saying that these Western countries come here, they exploit our resources and enrich themselves at our expense. And they just bribe a few officials, top officials, a few presidents and so on, and take all our wealth out. So we are not going to allow that. We are going to work towards building our societies. And similar things are happening, you know, of course, as we see, we are talking about Bangladesh. Similar situation exists over there now.
Yeah. I have to ask you quickly. We have about 2.5 minutes, I would say. And I want to make sure we touch on the talks. We're now in this thing where the U.S. makes all the announcements. And they say, well, we're doing our best for the ceasefire. But it's beginning to sound like the old expression, the peace process. Meanwhile, they killed the mediator. So what's your assessment of where this so-called ceasefire is going?
They are going nowhere simply because Netanyahu doesn't want a ceasefire, because he knows that the moment there is a ceasefire, he would be arrested and taken to prison because he faces corruption charges as well as charges of failing to protect or prevent the October 7 attack, etc. Although Hamas has said, the latest statement that they issued yesterday was that they said there is no need for any further mediation. There was a peace proposal, ceasefire proposal announced on May 31st, which we have accepted, and all we need to do is to start working on the modalities.
Aha.
Joe Biden had very, you know, publicly announced on May 31st in the afternoon in a press conference at the White House that he has a ceasefire proposal that Israel has proposed, and that this should be implemented. But, you know, any time that discussions are take place, that Israel simply introduces more conditions. In fact, even his own negotiating team are very frustrated with Netanyahu's tactics because they know that Netanyahu does not want a ceasefire.
Yeah.
So I really do not see any chances of a ceasefire, except perhaps if, let's say, there is this possibility that Iran and Hezbollah are persuaded not to retaliate for the crimes that Israel committed, and that Israel agrees to a ceasefire, then that might perhaps be something that could we could see occurring. But I really don't have too much hope in that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, that's a very nice summary. I do appreciate it. Zafar Benkash, thank you very, very much. It's very timely.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank you.
This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I want to thank Pedro for a terrific work. And Steve Fruitman, 33, 45, 78 is coming up.